Chapter 3 Towards the Idea of Pakistan. Forts, tombs and mosques summed up the presence of the Mughals in West Pakistan, for R.E.M. Wheeler. These markers of conquest and conviction have created a physical landscape that is aesthetically awe-inspiring as well as spiritually soothing. At the same time, they are provocative and politicized in both the shared and partitioned history of the subcontinent, where from the 11th to the 18th century, Buddhism migrated, Sikhism manifested, Hinduism strengthened, and Islam became established. Above all, culturally, it was this period that produced a protracted, hybridized composite Indo-Islamic identity, in the words of its eminent chronicler, Richard M. Eaton, which was to be at stake in the politics of the mid-20th century. From Delhi Sultanate to the Mughals. Being near the northwestern frontier and the southeastern extremity, Punjab and Sindh, respectively, always remained vulnerable to ambitious neighbours from all directions. In the north, Lahore was at the heart of incursions and conquests, a situation which only changed with the third Mamluk king, Iltutmish, who reigned between 1211 and 1236, who shifted the seat of political power in the region to Delhi. One of the byproducts of shifting power to Delhi from Lahore was that it rendered Lahore relatively unimportant for the succeeding two centuries. Power instead shifted to places such as Dipalpur and Multan, which emerged as cultural and commercial centres, while Ajudahan, present-day Pakpatan, found eminence as the seat of the Sufi mystic Baba Farid, 1173 to 1266. Multan was at times associated more with Sindh, with its Sufi mystic cult of Lal Shahbaz Kalande, 1177 to 1274, than with Punjab, and this is reflected in its Multani dialect and its Uch market. To pick up the historical tapestry from slightly before where it was left in the last chapter, Mahmud of Ghazni's raids into the northwest and southwest of the subcontinent between 1001 and 1025 are today either celebrated in Pakistan or condemned in India. Both sides forget that these are emotions and traditions manufactured by the English East India Company and its successor, British Raj, in the mid-19th century. These were colonial attempts to make and write the history of the region they were starting to rule. The Ghaznavid dynasty was of Turkic origin and ruled from Lahore until the arrival of the Ghurids, who conquered Lahore in 1186 and reached Delhi by 1206. The Ghurids were of Persian descent and began the percolation of Persian cultural and linguistic influences into the subcontinent. Centuries later, in 1987, the Pakistani military gave a nod to their memory by naming its medium-range missiles Ghuri 1-3, after Sultan Muhammad Ghuri. The period that followed is collectively referred to as the Delhi Sultanate. Ruling from Delhi, five Turkic Afghan dynasties, the Mamluk dynasty, 1206-1290, the Khalji dynasty, 1290-1320, the Tughlaq dynasty, 1320-1414, the Sayyid dynasty, 1414-1451, and the Lodi dynasty, 1451-1526, ruled over extensive parts of the subcontinent from 1206 to 1526. It is during this period that we start to see increasing cultural synthesis and the emergence of an Indo-Islamic civilization, reflected in monuments and language from the lofty heights of the Qutb Minar Minaret, named after the founder of the Delhi Sultanate Qutb-ud-Din Aibak, and now a UNESCO World Heritage Site, to the development of the grassroots vernacular of Hindustani, Hindu-Urdu, in the Deccan Plains of North and Central India. Attached to the royal court of Aluddin Khalji, who ruled between 1296 and 1316, the poet-musician Amir Khusro, considered the father of Urdu Hindavi literature, began fusing together Indo-Persian influences, weaving them through mystic, devotional poetry. Urdu was ultimately to become the rallying voice of the Pakistan movement of the early 20th century. By the mid-14th century, the Moroccan scholar Ibn Battuta, 1304-1377, was also speaking of the Delhi Sultanate of the Tughlaqs as an Indo-Islamic empire of Hind and Sindh, yet again echoing unconsciously a variation of the two-region theme. But it was not until the rulers who have collectively come to be known as the Great Mughals established their power that Indo-Islamic culture received state patronage and took root in the subcontinent. Babur Zahir-ud-Din Muhammad, 1483-1530, a descendant of the Mongol Genghis Khan, 1162-1227, and the founder of the Timurid dynasty, Timur or Tamerlane, 1336-1405, came first, marching across the Punjab to take Lahore in 1524. 2 years later, in the Battle of Panipat, present-day Haryana, India, he defeated the Lodi forces and heralded Mughal control of North India. What followed was a reign of nearly 200 years by the great Mughals, ending with Aurangzeb in 1707. Humayun succeeded his father Babur in 1530, but his rule was punctuated by Shir Shah Suri, a Pashtun ruling from his kingdom based in Sasaram, Bihar, India, and famed for his building of the Grand Trunk Road. It was Humayun's son, Akbar, who ruled between 1556 and 1605, who earned the sobriquet, the Great, for being a conqueror of territories, consolidator of states, and creator of a syncretic and pacifist culture of Din-e-Ilahi, a multi-faith religion, and Sulh-e-Kul, peace and reconciliation. He went through the Punjab and up the Khyber Pass to capture Kabul in 1586, moved his capital to Lahore that year until 1598, and again traversed the Punjab, journeying down the Indus to capture Sindh in 1591. Thus, from the Hindu Kush Mountains to the Arabian Sea, once again an attempt was made to systematize, centralize, and hybridize the state over these multi-ethnic religious societies by carving out subas, provinces, and laying the foundation of colonial and present-day provinces. At its pinnacle, Akbar's subcontinental empire saw a great patronage of art, craft, and architecture. Jahangir, who ruled between 1605 and 1627, followed his father Akbar to the throne and was, temperamentally, better suited to the dexterity and insight required for the arts than to court politics. In popular imagination, he is better remembered as Salim through his legendary tragic love affair with Anarkali, a Mughal courtesan from Lahore. There is an equally famous Anarkali bazaar there. The more substantial, if not scandalous, relationship was with his wife, Nur Jahan, 1577-1645, who was a widow when Jahangir married her and who earned his complete confidence in his last years, to the extent that she emerged in her own right as an empress and had coins minted in her name in 1627. Both Nur Jahan and Jahangir are buried not too far from each other in the city of Lahore, today serving only to attract the occasional tourist. The reign of Jahangir's fourth son, Shah Jahan, lasted 30 years, 1628-1658, and this period was the zenith of Mughal architecture, producing mighty and beautiful structures in a new Indo-Persian Saracenic style. The Red Fort and Jama Majid in Delhi, the Taj Mahal in Agra, and Wazir Khan's Mosque and Shalimar Gardens in Lahore all capture the political ability of the Mughals to penetrate all aspects of life. On the military front, expansionism and retreat went hand in hand during this time, and the Mughals' Afghan territories were lost in the 1640s. Henceforth, the Attock Fort on the Indus became the de facto outpost of subcontinental influence towards West and Central Asia. Aurangzeb, who ruled between 1658 and 1707, was the next and last of the great Mughals. He sought pragmatically to pacify the Pashtun tribes beyond the Khyber, and with good reason. In 1667, a Yousafzai chieftain of the Sawat Valley, and in 1672, the Afridis, Pashtun tribe, rose in rebellion. Following this, in 1674 to 1675, Aurangzeb spent a year in the Peshawar region, winning over tribes, stabilizing the northwest frontier, and leaving a blueprint that would be followed by the British Indian and Pakistani states alike. The later part of Aurangzeb's reign saw him clash with communities like the Sikhs under Guru Tegh Bahadur, 1621 to 1675, and Guru Gobind Singh, 1666 to 1708, in the Punjab. Aurangzeb's political ambitions, combined with his personal piety, which saw him endow the Grand Badshahi Majid in Lahore, one of modern Pakistan's most iconic structures, translated into a classic case of imperial overreach and led to the decline of this dynasty. Sufis and Sikhs. When India and Pakistan were created in August 1947, it was the Sikhs who suffered the spiritual division of their faith. Through the medieval period, with the establishment of Islam on the one hand and increasing alienation with the Brahmanical order on the other, the Punjab region had changed considerably, and these conditions saw the advent of a new religion. Nanak, 1469 to 1539, born in Talwandi, present-day Nankana Sahab, Punjab, Pakistan, preached a new type of message. It was partly born out of the Bhakti, devotional, movement, which rejected the rigidity and compartmentalization that both Islam and Hinduism preached. Fearlessly anti-Brahmanical, it found resonance among people in the region and established a following. The Bhakti movement had arrived to meet and mingle with the mystic Sufis, and together, both set about challenging their respective orthodoxies like never before. Personal and popular, direct and simple, poetic and spoken or sung, these movements appeared across regions in different vernaculars. Distancing himself from both Hindu and Islamic traditions, systems and institutions, Nanak settled down at Kartarpur, present-day Punjab, Pakistan, on the banks of the river Ravi, and preached upon the importance of meditating in the name of God, but at the same time maintaining a family and community life, as opposed to becoming a renouncer. The fluid cultural milieu of early Mughal Punjab permeates the pages of the early Sikh sacred text, Adi Granth. It includes the devotional verses and hymns of many poets, saints, and Sufis, cutting across religious boundaries, whose names are familiar across the northern part of the subcontinent, names such as Sirdar, who died in 1573, Kabir, who died circa 1518, Namdev, who died circa 1350, and Ravidas, who died in 1540, as well as Baba Farid. The growth of the Sikh faith occurred against the backdrop of the rise of the Mughals, and this led to confrontations. While Akbar had cordial patron relationships with Nanak's successors, it was with Jahangir that Sikh-Mughal relations started to decline. The fifth guru, Arjan, 1581 to 1606, gave refuge to the emperor's rebellious son, Khusro, and Jahangir ordered his execution. It was, however, with the ordering of the execution of the ninth guru, Tegh Bahadur, 1664 to 1675, that Aurangzeb set in motion a fateful clash with the tenth and final guru, Gobind Singh. During the chaotic period that followed the death of Aurangzeb, Punjab witnessed the decline of Mughal influence and the rise of the Sikhs as strong contenders for political dominance in the region, which eventually led to the establishment of the first Sikh kingdom in Lahore, under the leadership of the young Ranjit Singh in 1801. This was the pinnacle of Sikh political power, which declined following the death of Ranjit Singh in 1839. Interestingly, and not without controversy, The legacy of Ranjit Singh has been resurrected in Lahore in recent years, including the inauguration of a statue of him as a true son of the soil in 2019, an example of a reassertion of regional identity over religious affiliation. On the other side of Punjab is Sindh, a sleepy backwater in comparison to the Pathan frontier, but as historian Sarah Ansari observes, a world of Wadaros, Sadars and Pirs, feudal landlords, tribal chiefs and Sufi saints. The province of Sindh has the largest number of Hindus in Pakistan today, with a significant number of followers who are Nanakpanthis, followers of Nanak. A strong characteristic of these regions is the ways in which the institutionalized faith coexists alongside informal allegiances to Sufis, Pirs and Gurus. Collectively, Punjab and Sindh saw a rising Muslim piety under charismatic Sufi sheikhs, teachers, and their orders, with two key names of the 13th century being those of Baba Farid in western Punjab and Bahauddin Zakaria, who died in 1267 in southern Punjab. These Persianate Sufis, together with the Persian wheel, used to lift water in farming, set the towns of Punjab on their way to becoming the region's breadbasket with a rich local identity. A century later, under Firuz Shah Tughlaq, who ruled between 1351 and 1388, Punjab would see the first of its major phases of canal construction from its many rivers, thereby further expanding cultivation and settlement. This was in stark contrast to Sindh, where pastoral communities were suffering from famine in the 13th century. Much of this region would later witness vast social engineering, which began innocuously in 1831. Alexander Burnes, 1805 to 1841, a young political agent of the East India Company, led a mission from near the mouth of the Indus in Sindh, navigating one of its tributaries, Ravi, to reach Lahore. The stated aim was to take a gift of 5 horses from King William IV to Ranjit Singh. It was played as an opportunity to build alliances, but the real reason behind the expedition was to map the river Indus and its tributaries. This was a precursor to the company annexing first Sindh, 1843, and then Punjab, 1849. A far cry from its humble beginnings during Jahangir's reign as seeker of Mughal seals for maritime trade in the Indian peninsula. Within half a century, Punjab would see canalization and formation of canal colonies by the British state on an unprecedented scale. And in another 2 decades, the region would pay its gratitude and debt in blood by contributing well over 100,000 soldiers to the British war effort of the First World War. Both India and Pakistan, much like the colonial state, have employed these historical periods selectively, exclusively, and separately as a political football to chronicle a divided religious history to feed into the creation of 2 separate nation-states. In doing so, they have either rendered invisible the indivisible cultural connects of a shared syncretic literature, or ignored cultural figures, as opposed to men of state. Thus, in addition to those mentioned earlier, figures such as the poet Waris Shah, 1722 to 1798, composer of the love ballad Hir Ranja, and Bulah Shah, 1680 to 1757 in Punjab, and Shah Abdul Latif, 1689 to 1752, and Sachal Samast, 1739 to 1827, their Sindhi counterparts, remain important reminders of the rich interaction between 2 regions deeply influenced by the linguistic worlds of both Persian and Sanskrit, whose fruit was the Indo-Islamic Urdu or Hindustani, and, at the same time, strong regional outpourings in local vernacular folklore. Seeds of dissent. In the aftermath of the great Mughals, a number of successors continued to rule in their shrinking, fragmented form between 1707 and 1857, relinquishing power to their regional commanders, or Subadars, and losing the battle against the new imperialist rising and expanding in the region, the British. Their East India Company had received the Royal Charter in 1600 during the last days of Akbar, but the relationship that was cultivated during Jahangir's period was completely severed when the descendants of this Mughal dynasty, under British custody since 1803, were brutally and retributively killed following the recapture of Shah Jahanabad, Old Delhi, in 1857 by British officers. The last king, Bahadur Shahasava, was exiled and died in Rangoon in 1862, and with that ended the subcontinent's long association with the Mughals. The baton of power now passed on to the British Crown, which took over direct control following the revolt of the Sepoys in 1857, which had broadened to other sections of society and spread from Calcutta to Delhi. The Sepoy mutiny lasted for almost a year and cast a long and dark shadow over British rule in India, with constant fear of rebellion and treachery. Following from it, the British officials began collecting census data in the 1870s, which classified and categorised people, and thus began to entrench communal identities that would ultimately lead to the creation of India and Pakistan. Whether one sees the uprising against the East India Company in 1857 as a mere Sepoy mutiny, or a peasant feudal rebellion, or nothing short of the First War of Independence, the point is that it forms a rupture, in the aftermath of which we begin to see a first wave of the vilification of the Muslim other by the British. The new colonial power was keen to suppress any rekindling of sympathies for the outgoing Mughals, a feeling that was reignited during the days leading up to the rebellion. The Muslim community, dubbed as Phantom Wahhabi, were especially targeted and treated with suspicion. Further, the British had already established and harnessed their relationship with the rising Hindu middle class in the colonial cities of Calcutta, Bengal, Madras, and Bombay, which were the first three presidencies in the establishment of British rule in India. In the wake of this existential crisis, the Muslims of North India had to reinvent themselves from belonging to the ruling community to not merely being ruled, but minoritized and victimized. It is in this moment that one spots introspection and divergent paths being laid out, paths which would ultimately lead to the formation of two sovereign countries from a multitude of princely states and British-controlled provinces. In that space of soul-searching upon the changing power dynamics among the major communities of the subcontinent, there was much discussion within and between them around how to respond. Some collaborated with the ruling power, others retreated, but among the North Indian Muslims, for rather a long time, there was little appetite to embrace the new Western education espoused by colonialists like Thomas Babington Macaulay in his infamous Minute on Education of 1835, which set out to form a class of persons Indian in blood and colour, but English in tastes, in opinions, in morals, and in intellect. William Hunter, a Scottish historian and member of the Indian Civil Service, wrote the book Indian Musulmans in 1871. With a focus on Bengal, the book attempts to understand a class whom successive governments have declared to be a source of permanent danger to the Indian Empire. Elaborating, he directly addresses this in a chapter entitled The Wrongs of the Musulmans Under British Rule. Almost forgotten today, Hunter was, at one time, considered both the forebear of Muslim separatism and an emblem of the British policy of divide and rule. 4 years after Hunter's report was published, the Mohammedan Anglo-Oriental College was established, which would become the Aligarh Muslim University by 1920 and emerge as the cradle of the Pakistan movement. The establishment of the college by Sir Syed Ahmed Khan, 1817-1898, was a pivotal moment in the awakening of Indian Muslims, as it became the spiritual and rationalist homeland for the Muslim separatist cause. As early as 1887 to 1888, in a series of speeches, Sir Syed emphatically and controversially contemplated the consequences of what India would look like after the British left. Suppose that all English were to leave India. Who would be rulers? Is it possible that two nations, the Mohammedans and the Hindus, could sit on the same throne and remain equal in power? Most certainly not. To hope that both could remain equal is to desire the impossible and the inconceivable. In trying to understand the emergence of the idea of Pakistan, the late 19th century is crucial in creating these increasingly confrontational, totalizing identities of Hindus and Muslims. Intellectually, the impetus for these rudimentary ideas was being debated and refined by scholars such as Sayyid Amir Ali, author of Spirit of Islam, 1891, and Mulana Altaf Hussein Hali. Written on the request of Sayyid Ahmed Khan, Hali's Masadas-e-Mad-o-Jaseri-Islam, The Ebb and Tide of Islam, published 1879, is considered one of the earliest poetic articulations of creating a Muslim nation. The Urdu poem Masadas, written in the aftermath of the 1857 rebellion, charts the rise and fall of Islamic civilization in world history. Around the same time, in 1882, Anandamath, The Abbey of Bliss, by Bankim Chandra Chatterjee, was published but banned by the British. The novel led the Bengali literary renaissance and was part of an aggressive Hindu revivalism, but crucially, it was the nationalist movement's adoption of the idolizing song in the novel, Vande Mataram, Praise to Thee, Mother, that caused dissent between the communities. Set in the backdrop of the famine of 1770, the novel depicts Hindu Bengali nationalism against the Muslim Nawab of Bengal, who is seen to be in collusion with the British. Late 19th century British India was also a time of rapid socio-economic change, and one in which the British had both racially retreated from and yet powerfully penetrated deeper into Indian society. British legal and constitutional laws began to permeate into wider society, while the British maintained their separate lives in hill stations or cantonments. There were winners and losers. Competition for resources was stiff, and increasingly a climate of widening communal tension between different religious communities took hold. By 1905, there was a widening rift between Hindus and Muslims on issues like language, Hindu versus Urdu, and cow slaughter, both of which caused major riots in the 1880s and 1890s. These issues contributed towards the decision of Viceroy Curzon to partition the province of Bengal into a Muslim-majority east and a Hindu-majority west. The administrative rationale offered for this partition was reversed in 1911, but by then, the seeds of separation had sprouted. A rival to the Indian National Congress, INC, established in 1885, had been formed, blessed by Curzon's successor, Minto, to represent the disenchanted voices amongst the Muslim elite. The All India Muslim League, AIML, formed in 1906, successfully negotiated with Minto for separate electorates in the newly expanded legislative councils under the 1909 Morley-Minto reforms. The separate electorates were reserved seats in which only Muslims would be polled and elected. The idea, whilst protecting Muslim interests electorally and legislatively, entrenched the notion of a socially separate minority community or communities. Social and economic division was now firmly embedded in the political and constitutional framework endorsed by the colonial power. The Khilafat movement, 1919 to 1923, temporarily brought together Indian nationalists in support of restoring the authority of the Ottoman Caliphate following the end of the First World War. The Congress League Lucknow Pact of 1916 saw a brief period in which the Congress agreed to the principle of separate electorates for Muslims in exchange for working towards full Indian autonomy. This collaboration between the Congress and the League, between leading figures in the Caliphate movement, Begum Amam Bibi and her sons Mohammad and Shaukat Ali and Mohandas Gandhi, was an alliance of convenience more than anything else. It, however, paved the way for a non-cooperation movement in the wake of the continued agitation following the massacre in Amritsar in 1919, in which General Dyer ordered troops to fire at an unarmed crowd enclosed in the gardens of Jallianwala Bagh, which resulted in the death of 379 people officially, but many more unofficially. A fine reward for all the fighting that the Punjabis had done for King and another country, as Shabani Basu explores in her book on Indian soldiers on the Western Front. Through these muddy waters emerged two figures who would dominate the politics of the subcontinent for the next 30 years, Gandhi and Jinnah. Both Gujarati barristers by training, constitutionalists by temperament, and nationalists by character, who would eventually part ways and lead their people into two dominions, two destinies. The caliphate rug for Hindu-Muslim unity was anyway pulled from under its feet when Ataturk's Turkey abolished the caliphate in 1924. There now followed a decade of sharp deterioration in interfaith relations, with some of the first violent manifestations of communal rioting that would symbolise 1947. The interwar period saw a gathering momentum behind the INC's mass freedom movement, simultaneous political devolution by the colonial state, and persisting question marks, misgivings about the consequences of British departure and Congress, Hindu rule across provinces, with the fear that Muslims, and not only them, would be relegated as the poor other. Caste, Bhimrao Ramji Ambedkar. Ethnicity, Irode Venkatappa Ramaswamy. And class, Communist Party of India, established 1925, were all carved out as markers of separate spaces and opportunities in the political sphere, but none proved to be as powerful as religion. The Pakistan Movement. Growing out of the landed gentry across North and East India, the League found its greatest inspiration in Sir Allama Muhammad Iqbal, 1877 to 1938. Born in Sialkot to Kashmiri parents, educated in Lahore, Cambridge and Munich, and influenced by the poetry of Rumi, Iqbal put aside his academic and legal careers to write famous Urdu poems such as Shikwa, Jawabe Shikwa, Complaint, Answer to the Complaint. When elected as the AIML president in 1930, he delivered his aforementioned prophetic political speech on a Muslim India within India. The formation of a consolidated northwest Indian Muslim state appeared to him to be the final destiny of the Muslims of northwest India. 3 years after this speech by the spiritual father of Pakistan, Chaudhry Ramit Ali, 1897 to 1951, a young law student at the University of Cambridge, coined the term Pakistan, Punjab, frontier, Afghan, province, Kashmir, Sindh, Balochistan, in his pamphlet, which was delivered to the delegates at the Third Round Table Conference in London in 1931 to 1932, that was to consider the future government of India. These formulations would coalesce in Jinnah's address and the League's resolution at Lahore in 1940. The Lahore resolution became the linchpin of the Pakistan movement, even though the word Pakistan was not mentioned in it. Historians remain divided on how to interpret it, and for Aisha Jalal, this bargaining counter did not irrevocably commit itself to the idea of a separation of land and transfer of population. Nevertheless, it became a decisive clarion call in the final cry for Muslim separate nationalism over 1946 to 1947. So, what had changed in those few short years? To begin with, the political climate in the provinces, with the coming of the Government of India Act 1935, which provided the constitutional blueprint for independent Pakistan till 1956. The franchise was expanded, and the system of diarchy furthered. In the 1936 to 1937 elections, The INC performed well, winning across the board and leaving the AIML to wonder why it failed to connect with the Indian Muslims, especially where they were a majority population, in Punjab, Bengal, Sindh, NWFP and Assam. In the two largest of these five provinces, Punjab and Bengal, which would go on to become the base of two independent nations, Pakistan in 1947 and Bangladesh in 1971, regional markers and class politics reigned in these interwar years. However, the Congress rule from 1937 to 1939 in 8 out of 11 provinces served to provide a taste of what a majoritarian state bureaucracy felt like, and thus gave a fillip to the League's efforts in the subsequent half-decade. From 1939 to 1945, the events of the Second World War took over, wherein the Congress refused to cooperate with the British unless assured of independence immediately, while the League supported the war effort. A grateful colonial power seized upon this split, and, while putting the entire Congress leadership behind bars for almost 3 years, promoted the League, thereby killing any possibility of a united nationalist movement. These years proved critical for the League's political prospects, as it won over the regional Muslim leaderships of the Punjab, from where 60% of the soldiers of the British Indian Army came by now, and which would be key in the partition negotiations. By the winter of 1945 to 1946, when another round of elections to central and provincial legislatures, sometimes called a referendum on Pakistan, were held, results confirmed this shift in opinion, as the AIML won all Muslim reserved seats in the Central Assembly, while forming the governments in Bengal and Sindh. After tortuous negotiations over the prospects of a three-tier united India, Hindu provinces, Muslim provinces, and princely states, with a federal centre and constitution, the call for strength and thereby separation, immediate freedom and not protracted unity, proved too strong for the Congress, the League, and the by now desperate to decolonise British state. Ironically, the two regions or provinces to be partitioned were Punjab, which was again the province most involved in British war efforts, and Bengal, which had suffered the most because of these war efforts, which led to its famine of 1943 to 1944. No side, however, could foresee that the progress towards political freedom would dissolve into the insanity of mayhem, migration, and mass murder witnessed in August 1947. The Pakistan movement's most rigorous historian, Aisha Jalal, asked in the mid-1990s, "How did a Pakistan come about that served the interests of so many Muslims of the subcontinent so little?" Perhaps this was in response to the then-President General Zia-ul-Haq's pronouncement that if you took Islam out of Pakistan, it would collapse. But the question that predates Jalal's is, how and why did the large Muslim populations of Punjab, Sindh and Bengal, all between 50% and 70%, contribute so little and so late to specific and separate Muslim politics? Instead, at the forefront of Muslim politics were the so-called UP Muslims, a mere 14% of the population of that province, but providing the roadmap for Pakistan. This emergence of Muslim separatism, real and imagined, in North India, is a first-order fact to be grasped in any introduction to the present-day Pakistan. In trying to theorise and understand this incongruence of people and politics, historian Francis Robinson's pioneering work on separatism among Indian Muslims is important. He examines four possibilities. First, Muslim backwardness since the mutiny of 1857, produced by British discrimination against them as a punishment for their part in the mutiny. Second, British divide-and-rule policy, breaking up the composite, syncretic, subcontinental culture. Third, Hindu revivalism in the garb of Indian nationalism, driving the Muslims to organise politically as a community. And finally, Indian Muslims as a separate entity since the days of Muhammad bin Qasim, with the creation of Pakistan, an acknowledgement of this ever-present manifestation. that all these explanations share the assumption that Indian Muslims were a group whose situation, outlook, and interests were generally the same should be noted, alongside the realization that this was not borne out in the behavior of Balochis, Sindhis, Punjabis, Pashtuns, and Bengalis, who, until almost the last stages, were ambivalent about Muslim separatism. The great irony of the Pakistan movement is thus that the old Muslim centres such as Aligarh, Dhaka, and Lucknow, that were at the forefront of educational and organisational change, are not in fact part of modern Pakistan. Moreover, Muslims that make up Pakistan today had organised their politics around non-communal lines, and the communal basis that it has held since 1947 emerged later. These incongruities and differing aspirations amongst the Muslims of India are borne out in many respects. Jinnah was no clearer than anyone else about what his new imagined homeland would look like. The creation of Pakistan was supposed to provide a single, peaceful political solution to the question of the self-determination of Muslims in British India. The reality was much more complex, because Muslims were scattered all over the 11 provinces of British India, and were in a simple numerical majority in only 4 of them. The rest, short of getting up and going to Pakistan, were to be locked in a deadly sacrificial relationship between a Hindu-majority India and a Muslim-saturated Pakistan. Not every Indian Muslim in the days leading up to independence wanted to be part of that separate political project. Indeed, the 1951 census of Pakistan enumerates 7.2 million people as displaced persons, migrants from India. The majority located in West Pakistan. According to the 1951 census of India, 34 million, or 10% of the population, were Muslims, indicating that more chose to remain than migrate. Furthermore, alongside British India, there existed over 550 princely states. Semi-autonomous and indirectly ruled from Delhi, which comprised 1/3 of the land and 1/4 of the population. They were theoretically independent when British paramountcy ended in 1947, but realistically had no chance of exercising that choice. Their integration in either of the independent dominions has been called a bloodless revolution by historian Ian Copland, but it was a combination of bribery, chicanery, skullduggery with persuasion, coercion, and in cases like Hyderabad, Junagadh and Jammu, and Kashmir, outright bloody annexation, leaving bitter legacies. The princely states that acceded to Pakistan, though smaller in number, were no less problematic, and accession and integration was a long, drawn-out affair, as historian Yakub Khan Bangash has detailed. Understanding contemporary conflicts in Balochistan also requires an appreciation of its history vis-à-vis the accession of the Khanate of Kalat. Birth of Pakistan. The final, frantic days of British rule saw Indian politicians at the helm in a short-lived coalition, the interim government, before the clouds parted and partition appeared, with Mountbatten the last viceroy. The fate of millions was decided by drawing a line on a map through the east and the west of the subcontinent, approximating to the Muslim-majority areas in western Punjab and eastern Bengal. Those caught in these widening communal cracks fell mercilessly. Pakistan was born out of this political endgame in which a colonial power wanted to avoid being embroiled in a long and bitter civil war and was looking for a quick exit, while the two main political parties were equally eager to grab their share of pie as the only solution to the constitutional deadlock. In his haste to leave, Mountbatten brought forward British departure from June 1948 to August 1947 and announced it on the 3rd of June, leaving 72 days to undo a presence of 97 years in Punjab and 190 years in Bengal. The boundaries were drawn by the lawyer Cyril Radcliffe, flown in from the UK and asked to be swift, in the 5 weeks leading to British withdrawal. The boundary line was not made public until 3 days after the transfer of power at midnight on the 14th to 15th of August, for fear of people's response. This ill-conceived and ill-planned birth of Pakistan and independence of India created such a bittersweet moment that the trajectories of simultaneous celebrations and mourning can be traced to this day. For Pakistan, this emergence was especially challenging, because not only was it a newly created nation-state, but everything had to be effectively set up from scratch. Moreover, while Jinnah achieved his life's calling, it was not quite the Pakistan he had expected. Instead, it was a Pakistan split into eastern and western wings, separated by 1,000 miles of what became hostile Indian territory. He would term it a mutilated, moth-eaten Pakistan. On the 14th of August 1947, Muhammad Ali Jinnah was in Karachi, alongside Viceroy Mountbatten, welcoming a new dawn of freedom, engulfed in the fear and flames of communal violence. The worst of this occurred in the partitioned province of the Punjab in North India, where from March 1947 onwards, in Rawalpindi, communal violence and forced migration of people completely changed the landscape. Over the next year, but largely concentrated in August to December 1947, approximately 1 million people were massacred, and over 15 million were forced to leave from one side of the Radcliffe Line to the other. Bengal in East India, the other province to be partitioned, experienced all this in slow motion over almost 25 years. Other provinces in the newly created Pakistan, like Sindh and the NWFP, also saw religious riots and exchanges of refugee populations, but remained dwarfed in this narrative because the focus was dominated by the two borders of the new nations cutting through two old regions. The departing as well as the incoming authorities were unprepared for that moment when people would have to unceremoniously unmix centuries of intermingling and living together. There was no blueprint for the migration of people who were forced to flee their homes due to the fear of violence that was spiralling out of control. This fear only highlighted the lack of preparedness of the authorities. The partition and the momentous task of dealing with the refugee crisis was particularly acute in Pakistan, because in some areas, the refugee population notably outnumbered the local population, with consequences for both. The unequal exchange of people affected Pakistan and India unequally and proved a bigger burden on the former's much smaller and more fragile state apparatus. Pakistan inherited a state that was structurally weak, but with a strong military, and this would have implications in the years to come. But for now, it had to pick up the pieces and put together a new nation.